subsistence fishing for chum salmon on the Yukon River faces some closure this year because not enough king are getting through to Canada. Bycatch caps on the pollock fleet are being looked at. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today we will try to walk through this bycatch issue with a panel as the North Pacific Fishery Management Council meets in Nome. We're welcoming your calls from around the state at 1-800-478-8255. That is 478-TALK. And Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. It's salmon bycatch today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Okay, this thing gets complicated very easily, and I think it's difficult for journalists to understand and for the general public. But by golly, if it affects your bottom line, if it affects your fishing, this is important stuff here. Essentially, what we're talking about is bycatch. And the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, as the years have gone on, has taken measures, enacted a cap for Chinook bycatch, and is now considering what it needs to do about chum bycatch in the Bering Sea. So there's other bycatch. You got your Chinook bycatch and your chum bycatch, and they are both at a different stage of regulation. And that's only one part of the complication. There's also the difference between the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea. And then there's the situation of, well, where would the fish have gone that were caught out in the ocean? What river were they bound to, or indeed what country? And we'll be going into all of these things and many, many other complications. But at the end of it, it all sort of comes down to what are the measures that are taken and who should have the fish and who loses fish if one gains or so forth like that. So I guess where I'm going to start is with the Bering Sea Fishermen's Association. Karen Gillis is the executive director there now and with us in the studios of APRN. Welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning. Thank you, Steve.
Karen, maybe you could give me some idea. I think Bering Sea fishermen and I think, well, wait a minute. That's not the pollock fleet then, huh?
You are correct. Bering Sea Fishermen's Association is an entity that was established back in the late 70s and early 80s as an organization to serve the coastal small boat fishermen in Alaska. We serve coastal and interior communities, 128 in total, ranging from the Bristol Bay region at the south to the Arctic region up north. We serve both commercial and subsistence fishers, focused on providing and looking forward to abundant wild resources. When we're talking about salmon populations, lately we have found ourselves in an unfortunate situation, and Bering Sea Fishermen's Association is there to work on behalf of rural Alaska, essentially.
If there were plenty of fish, we wouldn't be talking about this.
Exactly.
But the problem, as I understand it, is that there weren't enough king salmon getting up the Yukon River into Canada, and so various things were done with varying degrees of success. And now it's gotten down to where it's even getting in the way of the chum fishery, which is not all that great either.
Right. And it doesn't necessarily, bycatch is a high seas issue. We're talking here about how the Bering Sea pollock industry fishery affects the chum and Chinook, which is, they are very different issues, as you mentioned earlier. Populations that are bound for our concern, Western Alaska and Canada.
Right. And as I understand, then the North Pacific Fishery Management Council has, as I said in the beginning, enacted this hard cap situation for Chinook salmon.
Correct.
But it's a little less further along, in dealing with the chum bycatch, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
The Chinook salmon bycatch issue was taken on first, and now they've moved to the chum salmon bycatch issue, which is on their table this week again.
Okay. And at the council meeting are a number of people. We have, for instance, the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association represented now on the advisory panel, and we have both the Pacific Seafood Processors Association and United Catchers Boats represented on our panel this morning, thanks to the studios of KNOM. So I think we'll start with John Groover of United Catcher Boats. John, are you with us on KNOM?
Yep, good morning, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Great. Now, I think, John, the Pollock fleet would just soon, it didn't have any bycatch at all of salmon, right?
Oh, you bet. No, they're interested in catching pollock, and that's it for them.
And they do not profit from this bycatch, right?
No. Salmon is a prohibited species, and they catch some salmon in the process of catching pollock, but they retain them for purposes of counting and some scientific measurements that need to be taken from them, such as fin clips or DNA analysis. And other than that, some of them, if they're food grade, end up in a food bank program, and others are then are taken out to sea and discarded if they're not a food grade fish. But there's no value to the fishery as a prohibited species. You can't sell it as a pollock fisherman or any ground fish fisherman for that fact. So.
All right. Also in the KNOM studios and attending the Pacific Council meeting is Glenn Reed. Glenn, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
And I guess my question to you would be, what is the way that the process is moving forward? It said is one of the things that industry is interested in is that it gets a level playing field. In other words, that everyone gets treated the same by this. In other words, they all have to take measures to deal with this bycatch. Because if you have a hard cap, I mean, isn't there a real situation where, geez, a couple of vessels and all of a sudden there you are?
Yeah, the potential exists for hard caps, obviously, to shut the fishery down, which is the reason those are used as a tool in management is to. If you reach a certain point, the fishery shuts down. Certainly, all users have made changes to accommodate low chum runs. Probably, no one more than the subsistence users when they are unable to harvest fish for subsistence use. What we're trying to figure out, and it's a complex issue, as you mentioned in the opening, is why there's so much variability. Some seasons it seems like the chum are with the pollock all the time. Some seasons it seems like they're not. In the last 8 years, for example, the variability of chum bycatch in the Bering Sea has been from over 700,000 fish to around 13,000. And that's just in the last 8 years, or 5 or 6 years maybe, in that variability. So we're, I don't think it's a situation where people are behaving differently in the pollock fishery that creates a situation where 1 year they're at 700 and a few years later they're at 13,000. But we're trying to design things, and John Groover and others have been at the forefront of designing situations where as soon as we start seeing chum in the fishery, we move the boats. We close areas where there's lots of chum and move the boats around. We believe that's been successful, but there's no way to know how much we've avoided, and that's frustrating, I think, to us. And we continue to try to find things that will improve upon the systems we've invented in the past. We are very reticent to say that, this great reductions that we've had since 2005 when we hit that peak number are because of all the things we've done. We think certainly some of it is. But we also know that, like I mentioned, some years there just seems to be all sorts of chum swimming or feeding on the same feed as pollock or in the same areas all the time, and when we close some areas down, we go to other areas, and there they are still. So we're trying to resolve it and problem solve the issue as best we can. The Chum and the Bering Sea are a broad mix of Asian, Russian, U.S., West Coast, Alaskan chum. There's somewhere in excess of 4 billion chum salmon put into the Pacific and North Pacific each year by the U.S., Russia, and Japan primarily as hatchery fish. So the mix in the Bering Sea is fish from all over the world, or all over the Pacific Rim for sure.
All right, Glenn. I'm getting a headache now. You got to quit.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. I do that to people.
I can't get any deeper into this right now, and I want to introduce Becca Robbins Gisclair, Policy Director, Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association. Hi, Becca.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me on the show this morning.
It's my pleasure, and I want to get you to underscore the river considerations here. We've just heard that, from the industry, that there are more and more measures being taken to try and keep this chum bycatch from happening. I take it your consideration is not enough and not fast enough.
Yes, Steve. I think what we have in place now is really... we have some area closures on the books that the industry is exempt from because they're participating in a hotspot program, and that's been in place since about 2006 with the exemption. And as Glenn just said, it's really unclear how much of the low numbers that we've seen recently are due to that program. And I think, similar to what was done with Chinook, when we have these kinds of really severe salmon shortages happening in the river, subsistence restrictions, commercial fisheries that were once vibrant and supportive of communities that no longer exist, it's really important to take a hard look at the bycatch issues and really set a limit somewhere on what we think is acceptable as bycatch and what's really going too far and starting to take away from in-river users.
So what is before the council? There's not a decision this meeting, right? What do they have before them that's being looked at by you on the AP now?
At this meeting, the council has a draft analysis of sort of the different options, what they call alternatives that they're looking at to reduce chum salmon bycatch. And there are four alternatives on the table right now. And basically at this meeting, what the council is doing is kind of taking a look at that analysis. It's the first time they've seen this document. It's about 800 pages overall, so it's going to take some time to really dig into. But the council has the opportunity at this meeting to change those options that they're looking at, make any adjustments, make suggestions for the analysis. They also have the opportunity, if they want to select what's called a preliminary preferred alternative, or PPA, that kind of signals where the council wants to ultimately go when they take final action on this. And at this meeting, the alternatives they're considering are a hard cap and a range of numbers for that from 50,000 to 353,000, some triggered area closures that basically close down an area instead of the whole fishery when the numbers are reached, and the ranges for those are 25,000 to 200,000. And then a fourth alternative is sort of similar to what we have now with the hotspot program, but with a much bigger closure area as the backup for the exemption. So the council will be looking at those, and one of the alternatives is always the status quo or current conditions.
Okay,
the council will be looking at those.
You're making my headache too. Now, which one do you favor?
We don't have a preferred alternative at this point. This analysis just came out a couple weeks ago, and as you can imagine, it takes a little while to get through 800 pages. our main concern is really making sure that we have something that's going to protect Western Alaska salmon stocks. As you heard, there's a mixture of a lot of different salmon runs in there, and I think we really want to make sure that whatever's adopted meets that objective. And I think that there are probably a couple different ways of doing that that are going to be a little more complex, I think, than the Chinook salmon issue. And so it's going to take us a little more time to really nail that down.
Yeah. I guess also you don't have the situation so much with the Chinooks where you have all these hatchery, there's hatchery chums, I guess, coming from Asian countries, lots and lots of them.
You know, it's an interesting point. There are a large contribution of Asian hatchery stocks, somewhere in the 60% to 70% range of the bycatch. But it's interesting. We're not quite sure what's going to happen with the recent impacts from the tsunami in Japan. I understand that a number of the hatcheries and their brood stock have actually been destroyed, so that might have some real significant effects on what the sort of mix of chum salmon stocks are. But that is a big one of the significant differences between the chum and Chinook salmon bycatch issues.
All right. Thank you very much, Becca Robbins-Gisclair. Is it Gisclair or Gisclair?
Either way.
Oh, okay.
Both are. My Cajun husband says both are okay.
I like that. Let's go to Roger, joins the program from actually just down the trail in White Mountain. Roger, welcome to Talk of Alaska with our panel of fish people today.
Oh, good morning. The Russian, Asian, and U.S. vector trawler fleet drag the waters for many species of fish. If we don't know who all the players are out in the waters are, my question is, how will we know what's really happening out there concerning chums, kings, et cetera? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Yeah, well, Roger probably knows, as everybody on our panel knows, that's kind of the $64 million question. Everybody's always wondering what's going on out there in the high seas. Are we making any progress at all, Glenn Reed, in knowing a little bit more about what other countries are catching, when, where, and so forth?
Thank you, Steve and Roger. I guess there's a number of questions in there. The high seas issue has been dealt with over the last probably 30 years or so fairly effectively. There's no doubt there's still some high seas fishing going on that at some level, but it's been dramatically reduced as far as we know through treaty agreements or through other agreements, and I think our U.S. Coast Guard has been key in that. But clearly there's stuff we don't know. We don't know what's going on out there to the extent that we'd like to.
So is the Russian catches, they're all reported? Japanese catches are all reported?
Anecdotally speaking, my personal opinion is probably not. And I think it's a great question. And we've done some cooperative work with Russian scientists in the pollock fishery on surveys and tried to get to additional cooperation on things like bycatch. The Russians, for example, have applied for Marine Stewardship Council certification to get their pollock fishery certified as sustainable, and they're in that process. And one of the issues is accounting for bycatch and having observers to do that accounting. So I don't know how that process is going for them, but if they continue to move forward with it, that'll be one of the things they have to deal with in a more open way than perhaps they have in the past.
I just have to laugh when you bring that. I just have to laugh when I know of Russian fishing.
Well, and I spent a number of years in Russia myself, so I'll laugh with you about that. But that's what we know. There's, like I said, there's a lot more that we don't know.
Yeah.
And I think that's why it's a great question. There's just a lot of unknown relative to that. Our pollock fishery in the U.S. is either 100 or 200% observed. All the salmon is counted, a census count, and we're you know, kind of leading the pack in those sorts of things, and we know we have more to do as well.
Yeah, Karen Gillis.
Well, I think Roger, that was a great question, and for somebody from White Mountain, it's a good sign for me to know that that these things are on your mind. They're bycatch is currently low. It has proven itself to be absolutely unpredictable. So when we look at what we do know, specific to Western Alaska chum, which of course I tend to dominate to, there is a higher mixed stock prevalence in the June and July fishery, June and July time frame within the pollock fishery. We also know that a large area closure would probably provide the highest potential for bycatch reductions. However, that is a very drastic measure, and we, Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, have been supportive and engaged in the pollock industry in so much as this community development quota program is involved as well here. So
you betcha.
We are not out to shut down or impact the pollock industry in any negative fashion.
So are you liking the small area closures then?
We're just not quite there yet either. I will ditto Becca's comment that there's still a lot of information to take in, and we are kind of standing down from a public position at the moment.
Absolutely fascinating. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If calling from Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. Feel free to chime in. You can email also, but we have a new email address, so I don't think the old one is working because I don't see any new emails coming in here, so maybe I better tell you the new one, which is talk@alaskapublic.org. You got that? talk@alaskapublic.org. Everything in lowercase there, and then we can see your email. And as many veteran players on this program know, as things tend to jam up towards the later part of the show, an email can be a very convenient way to get your message through or to get your question asked, because I got millions of questions, but nobody's got any answers right now. Nobody has got any answers right now. What we have is a lot of facts, and then eventually we, of course, get to some guessing. Let's go to Tim, who joins the program from Nome. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tim.
Well, good morning, Steve. This is Tim Smith.
Howdy do.
Yeah.
So tell me, what did you call for?
Well, I'm the president of the Nome Fishermen's Association, and our organization, along with most of the local organizations, is asking for a 30,000 chum hard cap in the Bering Sea, Aleutian Island pollock fisheries. We think that's achievable and justified. In the last 3 years, the trawlers have averaged about 25,000 chum salmon as bycatch, and we'd like to hold them to a fairly low hard cap. This area has been dealing with the chum salmon shortages for 25 years now, and things don't seem to be getting better.
Do you see any options of some kind of hard cap with an incentive program of some sort, like they did ended up with for Chinook?
They don't have nearly as many tools to work with chum salmon. I don't know how well it's going to work with Chinook salmon. But nobody seems to think that that type of program would be effective with chum salmon.
Okay, well, I'm in charge of the dumb questions. So. Good. All right, well, scratch that question then. And your number again for a hard cap?
We're asking for 30,000.
And what about like some kind of seasonal element?
Well, it does. It may be worth it to close it during the times of the year when they think that Western Alaska chum salmon are more vulnerable in midsummer. The problem is it's a mixed stock fishery, and the chum salmon are all lumped into one big pool from Bristol Bay to Kivalina. And so we have some rivers that are in really bad straits here. They're declared stocks of concern. And, you know, nothing can really guarantee that those fish from those stocks of concern won't be taken at any time of the year. We just don't know enough about salmon movement. So it may be worth something. I don't know. There just isn't enough information to really manage the fishery. And I think that's really the problem with resolving these issues.
Well, but we do have more information than we once had. I guess everyone would agree we need more information. Okay, let's go to either John Groover or Glenn Reed. Maybe you'd like to respond to this push from Nome, where the rivers are particularly troubled. And Tim is suggesting, okay, time for a hard cap, 30,000. What do you think?
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Tim, I guess, you know, 30,000 fish hard cap, it sounds like a lot of fish, but I think at this point, a person needs to look at the analysis and using the best genetic and scale sampling information that's been put together over the years, you need to look at what kind of protection that brings you. And certainly that data and that work is just kind of at the tip of the iceberg. And that would take time for the geneticists to do a much better job of developing a baseline, because I think it's an awful rough cut right now. But shoot, you know, if you stop the Bering Sea pollock fishery at 30,000, and you look at the data that's available, what you've done is a in the western Alaska coastal areas is save up to possibly 450 chum salmon. And, you know, by what actually returns in western Alaska. And I'm not saying that's a perfect number here, but I think we need to take time and look at that and see if we can't give the geneticists a better idea and a better real-time measure to do that. And our rolling hotspot program right now is a very rough program in that it looks at where bycatch occurs and puts closures together. And one element that could make that program a lot better is if we could tie that in with genetic information, and instead of just looking where the highest bycatch occurs, where we put closures together to protect a majority of hatchery fish from Asia and Russia, we can concentrate those hotspots and protect stocks from western Alaska. And I think there's a lot to be gained by giving the science a chance to catch up with what our industry and a rationalized fishery is able to accomplish.
Tim in Nome?
Yes, Steve. I guess I would take issue with the detail of the genetic information. I don't think it's really scientifically valid to calculate how many fish would be saved by any of the hard cap options. The genetic information on chum salmon is very, very poor, and the fish are not randomly distributed. That's another important issue, that if you take 30,000 fish from a mixed stock fishery, there's no guarantee that an excessive number might be coming from the Nome River, for example.
Yeah, I see. So basically, in a way, you're kind of saying the same thing, but you're saying, well, let's get the hard cap now.
Yeah.
And Glenn is saying we need to wait for more science, which is going to tell us more, which it probably will, don't you think, Tim?
Well, it hasn't so far. We've been doing genetic studies since the 80s, and so far it hasn't produced anything on a level of detail that will help manage the weak stocks in Norton Sound. And I think it's a real issue of sustained yield. As you know, Steve, the Alaska Constitution requires management for sustained yield, and driving some of these chum salmon stocks to extinction is not sustained yield.
All right, Tim, I want to thank you so much for your call.
Thanks, Steve.
All right. It's Talk of Alaska. The North Pacific Fisheries Management Council is meeting in Nome. The actual council is, I don't believe, begun its meetings, but the panels preparatory to it, where the action is, are taking place, and we're seeing that things are very fluid around the issue of chum salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea. And this is only one of several different bycatches we could be talking about. We're not talking about the Gulf of Alaska Chinook, which suddenly spiked for reasons that are mysterious. And hopefully we won't go into that. And our email address is talk@alaskapublic.org. That's a change from the old email, talk@alaskapublic.org. We have calls piling in here at 1-800-478-8255 or a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422 as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking chum salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea. It's under discussion at the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and we've got a bunch of the players in the situation here and others calling because this is an issue that draws avid interest in Alaska. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email has changed to talk@alaskapublic.org. Okay, I think I'll go to the Becca Robbins-Claire of the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, who is on the advisory panel and speaking from Nome. And Becca, I think it's important that you probably heard Tim's call there from down the street in Nome, and he was calling for a hard cap of 30,000. But I don't think that's in the alternatives, is it?
No, that's correct. The lowest hard cap that's considered in the alternatives is 50,000.
And as you said, you know, you're not ready to take a position from the Yukon River on which or any of these. And the same with Karen Gillis of the Bering Sea Fishermen's Association, not ready to take a position. But it is interesting to note when you look at how chum spiked that it wasn't just 1 year, that it actually built up and up and up, and then it hit that huge 700,000. Then it drops down to like 300,000. So it's like, you know, what was up with that? It seems like there ought to be, that is such an enormous signal that it has to come from somewhere scientifically. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think that's, you've hit on another of the $64 million questions here. I think if we knew exactly why those numbers fluctuated as they did, we'd probably have a much easier answer to how to address this subject.
Well, could it be related to fishing effort in some way? Or could there have been some kind of gear change or something in the industry that, or an artifact of the observing process? I mean, this is just, I mean, I'd cover science, and when you see a spike this big, it means something. There's a reason for it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, our industry guests can probably address the issue of whether they were doing anything different. The other big factor in this is, of course, abundance. And one of the things that makes this really challenging to figure out is we don't have a good estimate of what the abundance of chum salmon in the Bering Sea at any given point is. If we had that, it would make setting a cap fairly easy because it could just fluctuate with that. But it's one of the big unknowns that makes this really hard to pinpoint.
Yeah. Okay, maybe John Gruver of United Catcher Boats, any gear change that you can think of that happened, or do you have any guesses? I mean, you know, fishing people develop intuition about things. Any guesses to how this spike happened so radically and kind of built up to it and then dropped down? And there was the spike in the Chinook bycatch is very similar in shape, but affects actually different years. Close, but different.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. But in regards to chum salmon, there is a very identifiable change, and that is that we had been running a rolling hotspot program since, and it was an evolving process. We started the first year of the rationalized fishery in 2000. And we started identifying hotspots and having these closures. But there was an older regulation on the books that came around in 1993 to protect chum and Chinook salmon. And it was closures that were put together based on large aggregated data, excuse me, and over a series of years, and didn't take it, you know, so out in the wash of putting that data together, you don't get discrete looks at bycatch. And the results was a chum salmon closure area that the council put together then, and it was based strictly on where people fished without knowing what would happen if you move them to another area. And so 2005 rolls along, and we had the trigger closure area that was on the books. It closed on August 1st, no matter what the conditions were, and the fleet was moved out of there by regulation, and they fished. They moved to where pollock fishing was still close to, you know, where they delivered in Dutch Harbor and Accutan, and bycatch went through the roof. At the same time, by luck, we had some CEQ vessels fishing inside that closure area that had worked off of a different trigger mechanism, and there we had the cleanest fishing. But in an area that was put in place to protect chum bycatch, actually increased chum bycatch. And we don't know the genetic makeup of that bycatch increase that year, but we do know that had we been able to fish inside the chum salmon settings area, our bycatch would have been not just a little bit lower, but many, many, many times lower. And so as a result, the council said, well, this rolling hotspot program looks like a lot better control mechanism than this fixed trigger closure area that we really don't know from one year to the next what the bycatch is going to be in there. Let's go with a rolling hotspot program. If you meet these certain criteria that we negotiated and worked with both BECA and some other Western Alaska groups to develop some criteria requirements for the rolling hotspot program, we did that. We went to that program in place, and the first year we worked under an exempted fishing permit in 2006, partway through the season, and had some reduction in bycatch. But it was a learning process for us. We increased area closures and stuff. And in 2007, we started really hitting the bottom. And I'm not going to say that the rolling hotspot program gets all the credit. Clearly, there were less chum salmon on the grounds in those years as well.
Okay.
But that change was very significant.
Becca, I think I'll ask you for a response on that. I mean, we're hearing a fairly persuasive case here that the spike might have been partly because of an unintended consequence of management, conflicting management. And John, of course, is making the argument that this rolling hotspots thing is working and has been the solution. But I have a hunch that you're not quite on board with that.
Well, I think there's probably some other things going on in seeing such a big spike and such a small number afterwards. But I actually would agree with John on part of this, that, you know, the hotspot program, I think for Chinook, we didn't see it as being nearly as effective. But for chum salmon, you do see that since it's been in effect, the numbers are lower. I think that part of this action, we really need to look at that program and see if there's anything that could be tightened up in there to make it even more effective. And I do think that a hotspot program alone probably isn't enough to protect Western Alaska chum salmon stocks, particularly with the low returns we're having in some regions. And that, you know, it should be overlaid with some other management measure, whether it's a hard cap or a large area closure. But I do think that, you know, the hotspot program is something worth continuing to look at. It's not something that should just get thrown out in this round of council consideration.
All right. And also you think there's probably are some ecosystem factors here too.
Yeah, and that's where it's just really, really hard to say what's going on because we don't know exactly how many salmon are out there swimming around.
Well, we have an email at our new email address, talk@alaskapublic.org, from Julie. This would be from the River Interest. Julie Raymond Yakubian she is the Social Science Program Director of Kowarik, Nome, and she notes this about the comment process and NOAA's drafting of alternatives. Tribes that are dependent on chum and other salmon resources for their traditional subsistence, cultural, spiritual, and economic needs have been largely excluded from the development of the current set of alternatives, despite the fact that they're extremely concerned about this issue. The Council and the National Marine Fisheries Service need to greatly improve their communication and collaboration with tribes to ensure that tribal concerns are incorporated and addressed in the decision-making. And I believe that's called consultation. I believe that there is a presidential order on that. And I guess this is a call to try and take that a little bit more seriously. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255 statewide. In Anchorage, you can dial 550-8422 because that's where we're sitting, and that's a local call and saves us money. And let's go to Tony, joins the program from all the way out in Wales. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tony.
Good morning, Alaska, and all the fishermen that are listening. You know, I'm under the Federal Subsistence Advisory Committee.
Tony, before you go any further, can you just reach over there and turn the radio down a little bit because it's coming back in late? I love
okay,
this part.
How's that?
That's much better.
Okay. You know, I've been kind of puzzled about having to have set this, you know, this mess size for catching all these fish, you know, where they're bringing the mess sizes down to where they're catching all the juvenile fish that are carrying all the eggs. And the majority of our juvenile fish are the ones that are should be passing through to where they can go up the creeks instead of, you know, targeting all the big ones, should catch all the big ones and let all the small ones go, because the generation of the small ones are the ones that are going to be, you know, bringing out more of the young babies for more salmon. Another thing is that, you know, setting a hard cap for everybody out there in the seas, they got their own books. You know, we'll try ask them nicely to see if we can be able to have them, you know, follow our rules. But, you know, they got their own rules to where that they have their own meetings, and, you know, they'll do anything under the table to get all the fish that they can, which is hurting us here up here in Alaska. We're having to fight every year during the winter to buy fish from other neighboring villages because, you know, they're wiping out our fish completely down there.
All right. Thank you very much for that comment, Tony. And I guess I'm going to take that down to Becca of the Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association to maybe, Becca, you can kind of explain why Fish and Game enacted this mesh restriction along in the coastal villages.
Well, I think the mesh restriction on the Yukon River went into place this year. It's going to be in place this year for the first time, and that really impacts fishing for Chinook salmon. And it's really meant
what's
to address.
What's the deal? You set your mesh so small. I mean, because you want to let the bigger fish through. What's that mean? You're obviously going to get the big fish too. What? Then you have to let them go? How do they do that? I don't understand.
Well, they did a number of studies and. Both in the Yukon, and it's been done kind of throughout the world, it's pretty well established that, you know, a larger mesh size does catch larger fish. And on the Yukon, we've seen the larger, older age classes of Chinook diminishing in recent years. And
oh,
so,
I see. Because it's a gill net, I guess, the bigger fish gets stuck, whereas, in a smaller mesh size, it just finds its way around it somehow.
Yep, and on the Yukon, when they looked at this, they actually found the smaller mesh size that goes into place this year actually is more efficient at catching Chinook. So you catch more fish but smaller fish, and then the larger fish have a much greater opportunity to spawn and carry a lot more eggs. So it's important to get those fish up to the spawning grounds and eat the smaller fish.
Tony in Wales, do you have more? Have you hung up?
No, I didn't. I was just listening to her, and I kind of say that's a kind of a backward situation for us up here in Alaska, you know, having to catch the small ones, which can be growing much more larger and going up more creeks because they're smaller, and the big ones are just, you know, I don't know, the book that they're coming out with is pretty backwards, and I'm not too happy with it.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for your call from out there in Wales, Tony.
Okay. Thank you very much, and have a nice day.
I'm trying. It's difficult because fish is always a difficult one. It's Talk of Alaska, the telephone number 1-800-478-8255. We're talking chum salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea. There's some very preliminary alternatives put out by NOAA Fisheries, and the council is meeting in Nome as we speak. We've got a very, very fascinating panel of guests educating us all about all this, and we got a whole bunch of calls stacked up and coming in on Talk of Alaska. Let's take one now from Terry, who joins the program from Kodiak. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Terry.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for a little bit of time there.
Now, you're not gonna start with the Chinook and the Gulf, are you?
No, but I don't know if they've taken final action on that yet. I know they're meeting on that.
No final action yet.
They still have a range to take on enabling a hard cap there. And yeah, I think the lower end of the range is the more reasonable, because that's what will drive real innovation. And I really wanted to speak to the necessity of having a hard cap for the chum salmon in the Bering Sea as well. And there's only really the things that really spur innovation for this kind of thing in the industry are observer coverage and a hard cap. And I think that's true all across the United States. And the Bering Sea fishery has the observer coverage now. And if you enable a hard cap, I guarantee you those guys will find a way to not catch those fish. I mean, you know, I think it's important to remember that you shouldn't trade one resource for the other. I think that's a pretty good rule of thumb. And a pollock fishery, you know, you have to plug in the dollar sign into this equation too, because it's a tremendous amount of money. And industry has quite an influence on the council process and in the management process. And when you hear folks saying, well, we should slow down, not go too fast, make sure of our numbers, well, you know, that's the delaying tactic allows the pollock fishery to continue, and they want to continue to bring in their money.
But, Terry, they're demonstrating success. And this rolling hotspot thing, they're, you know, as far as we can tell, it's having success.
Well, everything has to have a hard cap going along with it. I think the East Coast guys have found that too. Without the hard cap, you just don't drive innovation the way you might.
Oh, Terry, are you the actual inventor of "I will not trade one resource for another"? I think you might actually have invented that.
I don't know. I never know. I hear good things, and I pretend that I invented them.
Okay.
I've gotten a lot of stuff from you, Steve.
All right. Thanks for your call, Terry, from Kodiak.
All right, thanks.
So there's a vote for the hard cap. Glenn Reed, you know, he does have a point. It seems like sometimes it takes a pretty strong incentive to make sure that you get action.
Steve, I think I guess my first thought is that a hard cap is a tool, and the toolbox has many tools, and not all tools work in this, for every situation. I think the argument that you can't invent good solutions without a hard cap is pretty much taken out of the equation by the fact that the rolling hotspot system that was invented after that regulatory closure area that John mentioned earlier was removed, and we could just simply move around away from where the highest bycatch was through that system, shows that you can invent a system without a hard cap that has at least been in part helpful in reducing chum bycatch. One of the things about trading one resource for another that we don't want to get into is our chum bycatch measures. We don't want them to conflict with our Chinook bycatch measures. The reason I believe that we took action, or the council took action on Chinook first, is because it's considered to be, by many people, more important in many cultural ways and other ways to have put first in line to take action on. There are fewer foreign fish, there are fewer hatchery fish, there are all sorts of other reasons, and Chinook is an iconic species in our state. So we put a priority on that, and we put a hard cap on that, and we took that action first. We don't want to go down the path of taking actions on chum salmon that get us in a position to conflict or cause problems with the reduction of Chinook bycatch. We want to reduce both, but we certainly don't want to trade one of those for the other, and we don't want to get the priorities backwards doing it. So that's how I would respond to that.
That's Glenn Reed of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. It's Talk of Alaska. We're dealing with Bering Sea chum salmon bycatch. And Karen Gillis, you want to chime in on this one?
Well, I will just maybe level the playing field a little bit to say that when you're talking about a region as large as Western Alaska, there are certainly multiple interests. I think it is unfair to characterize Chinook as more important than chum, or vice versa. Or,
well, I know which one I'd rather have. The other
and there
one
are
I'll
lots
give to
of
my
preferences.
Dog.
I appreciate that. I don't know if it would be possible to back up to, and I know that John characterized his reference to the statistics of how many Western Alaska chum are in there, and that a 450 might be saved. But when we are talking about
You're saying that's pretty bogus.
Well, what I'm saying is, if you take a bunch of M&Ms that are all different colors and you put them on the table and you close your eyes and you make a big scoop, if you got all of the blue M&Ms, you have extirpated all of the blue M&Ms. They will no longer reproduce. So in Norton Sound especially, when we're talking about sometimes less than 1,000 chum salmon returning to a river system, taking 450 or say 400 of that is a huge number. And so to say we only took a certain percentage is an absolute mistake.
Well, as someone who grew up without any blue M&Ms, you know, I would hate to deny future generations.
Thank you.
Their biodiversity of M&Ms. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
It's Talk of Alaska. We're talking chum salmon bycatch in the Bering Sea, and we've got some of the players with us by telephone from the meeting in Nome. Took a little time out from the meeting to participate in a discussion of this and help us all try and get up to speed as best we can on this very complicated management and allocation issue. One of the things we find out pretty quickly is a whole lot of these chum salmon come from someplace else. They come from hatcheries like in maybe Japan and so forth. And so a lot of the questions have to do with even if stringent measures were taken, how much would it really help the rivers in Alaska? And we just heard a passionate argument from Karen Gillis of the Bering Sea Fishermen's Association saying, hey, you know, if it's one river that all the fish are taken from, that's a problem. And it's a worthwhile consideration. Martin in Fairbanks replies by internet, says, hey, last year I watched a short video online about a team that had developed a rubber sheeted piece of equipment that allows bycatch to be sorted on board without hurting the fish. Anybody familiar with this? This is one for John Groover of United Catcher Boats. John, do you know anything about this kind of device that would basically allow those fish to be put back in?
Steve, I don't know anything about a rubber sheeted device. I know in Bristol Bay they're kind of creating a sled to get the fish to the fish holes and keep them in a nicer shape. But and I do work on bycatch reduction devices. In fact, John Govan and Dr. Craig Rose and I are maybe leading world experts on behavior-driven bycatch reduction devices. We've been to conferences around the country, and Craig travels around the world, and I know, and we've been working on a salmon excluder for midwater trawls. And we've been working on this project long before this was a council item on the agenda of the council. And we've been concentrating on both chum salmon and Chinook salmon. And as the council put more focus on Chinook, our excluder focused more on Chinook. And now we have a new exempted fishing permit we've applied for, experimental fishing permit. And that EFP work will start this fall, and we get concentrated on a chum salmon device. But we consider to be very successful. We sat through a presentation at the American Fisheries Society meeting in Boston a few years back where a guy from Australia swore no bycatch behavior-driven bycatch reduction device could ever be developed to do better than 10%. And right now we're between 30 and 40 with Chinook salmon. Our presentations kind of left him with his head hanging afterwards at the time. So it's a work in progress. It takes a long time to develop these devices, but we're making a significant progress. And much like the caller described the rubber sheet, this is not a salmon that wiggles through a hole and in a cloud of scales escapes. We use a dividing panel that creates a sort of a lee, like the rock and river does for a salmon that's swimming upriver. And then they get into that lee, and they swim forward a ways, and they go through an escapement hole that's 3 to 4 feet wide and 15 to 18 feet long. And as Dr. Rose would describe it, the only harm to the salmon is they get a little aerobic exercise.
Yeah.
And that's a device we're working on right now.
Great. Thank you, John Groover of United Catcher Boats. And I could talk about that technology endlessly because it just fascinates me, the same as offshore oil drilling technology does. It's just... wow, the inventiveness and the kind of hardware that people come up with, and how the difference a little shape can make is just fascinating to me, anyway. But Maybe it doesn't make the greatest radio, but I really appreciate that, John. Let's go to Paul, joins the program from Kotzebue. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Paul.
Hey, thank you a lot, Steve. Yeah, I'd like to know why was there TVQ all the way up to Killeen, not all the way up to Kotzebue? See, that's my concern, because where my buddy left off, Gordon Nito, when he passed away a few years ago, and Gene Starkweather, where is our name? Where is our, who can we, I'd like to be on the Board of Fisheries, where you left off.
Karen.
Why did it stop there? You know, I'd like to know.
Well, hi, Paul. This is Karen with Bering Sea Fishermen's Association. And I was involved in the organization back in 1992 when this was starting off. And I think there are a lot of people in your area. I know that my board members from your area have this same question. It's a very good question. I'd love to talk with you about it if you have the sense and time to call me and discuss it. So if you want to reach me, my toll-free number is 888-927-2732.
I'm not worried about your number.
I know.
No. Why? Why would it stop? Why was I seeing this?
I guess I'm only encouraging you to call me, Paul, because we're running out of time and the chum bycatch issue was
right
at the council today. So
yeah, it's basically that's as far as they went. They didn't go through the Bering Straits. they stayed down below the Bering Straits is a short answer on that. It's Talk of Alaska, and I want to thank all of the all of my panel members for their help in making this understandable to everyone. Becca Robbins Gisclair of Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, you've got the last word, but it's only 30 seconds.
All right. I guess I'd just like to stress that I think some of the numbers we talked about on impacts are really have a lot of uncertainty, and we're not really sure what the impacts are. And I think that really speaks to the need to make sure that we have some measures in place which will protect Western Alaska salmon. We've heard from people all over the area of how important this is, and hope that the council will hear those concerns and put something in place.
Glenn Reed, I guess you're kind of getting that message, right? You already got it.
Yeah, I think we do, Steve. And I think, you know, Becca's right. We know we need to continue to be vigilant and continue to invent ways to reduce bycatch. And, you know, we're not in favor of the low hard cap that Tim mentioned earlier. That's a four-year average. The previous 4 years was 10 times that average. So
okay,
we've got to find a way to understand the variability, and we're working on
all
it very
right
hard.
All right, we're out of time. It's going to be Coastal Zone Management next week. Thank you so much to Lorelei Kanin for helping us out from KNOM and making this show possible. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by
AT&T, Rethink Possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.